Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today is Wednesday. It's January 2nd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Well, we have a bit of a change. Initially, we thought that I would start off the show and then spoke to Mayor Richard Thomas from Mount Vernon. He thought he'd be able to make the show at 10 o'clock this morning, but then things changed. Evidently, Lisa Copeland, the president, she wasn't going to be in attendance at 10 o'clock, or he thought it would be later, but now she's coming in around 10 o'clock or so. So things have been, I guess, thrown into a tizzy, but no problem because we're expecting then the mayor to call us around 10:30. So let's get started on some of the big issues that have literally taken over and are confronting the world stage. And there are a lot of things that are going on. One of the things that is intriguing, and I didn't expect this to happen, evidently U.S. agents have fired tear gas at migrants that want to come across the Mexican border. Well, the U.S. Border agents launched tear gas into Mexico early Tuesday to deter a group of migrants that one official called a violent mob, quote unquote, from crossing over from Tijuana, according to a Reuters witness and the U.S. government. So clouds of the noxious gas could be seen wafting up from around the fence at the border, and one migrant picked up a canister and threw it back into U.S. territory. U.S. officials said the group had attacked agents with projectiles, but a Reuters witness did not see any migrants throwing rocks at U.S. agents. Tijuana has become a flashpoint in the debate over U.S. immigration policy, which has been intensified by the recent deaths of two migrant children in U.S. custody and a partial U.S. government shutdown over President Donald Trump's demand for $5 billion in funding for a wall along the border with Mexico. A previous incident in November when U.S. agents fired gas into Mexico to disperse migrants triggered a call from Mexico's government for an investigation. Now, a spokesman for Mexico's foreign ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Tuesday. Now, late on Monday, more than 150 Central American migrants approached an area of the border in Tijuana in the Playas neighborhood near the beach. Migrants said they thought security measures might be relaxed due to the New Year's holiday. After midnight, U.S. security personnel fired tear gas into Mexico as some migrants prepared to climb a border fence, according to the Reuters witness. And during a second attempt, migrants began to pass youths and children over the razor wire along the fencing to the U.S. side. U.S. Department of Homeland Security spokeswoman Katie Waldman called the group a violent mob, quote unquote, and said that they had thrown projectiles at agents who responded with the minimum force necessary to defend themselves, quote unquote. Congress needs to fully fund the border wall, Waldman said in a statement, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP, said in a statement that the gas was aimed upwind of people throwing rocks on the Mexican side who obstructed agents from helping the children being passed over razor wire. Now, the CBP statement said that agents had not directly targeted the migrants attempting to cross the fence with gas and pepper spray. A Reuters witness documented in one photo where a migrant had been hit by what appeared to be a gas. A CBP said said most of the migrants actually attempting to cross returned back to Mexico, while 25 people, including two teenagers, were detained. Now, thousands of Central American migrants have been camping at shelters in Tijuana since arriving in November after traveling in caravans across Mexico to reach the U.S. border, where many have hoped to request asylum. So that's the situation that's there. Now, there are other things that are going on around the world, which is, most interesting, of course. One thing is going on in the Middle East. The center-left opposition has splintered ahead of the Israeli elections. This was unexpected, but Israel's center-left opposition dramatically split on Tuesday ahead of an April 9 election, with leader Avi Gabay announcing he would no longer partner with veteran politician Tzipi Livni as she sat stone-faced next to him. Well, the announcement means the end of their Zionist Union Alliance, which secured the second most seats in the last general election in 2015, but has since slipped in opinion polls. The Zionist Union included Gabay's Labor Party and Livni's Hatnua. It won 24 out of 120 seats in 2015 behind Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing Likud, which won 30. Now, Gabay's partnership with Livni, which he inherited from previous Labor leader Isaac Herzog, had been uneasy since he took over the party's helm in 2017. Quote, "I still believe in partnership and connections and uniting a large camp committed to change, but successful connections necessitate friendship, upholding agreements and commitment to a course," Gabay told a meeting of Zionist Union Parliament members. "That didn't happen in this partnership," he said, adding that he believed Livni approached the podium immediately afterwards and said tersely she would take time to reflect on Gabay's announcement before responding. At a separate conference later, the former foreign minister admitted Gabay's announcement had taken her by surprise, rejected insinuations she lacked loyalty, and said the split was ultimately for the best. Gabay was right for one thing today. "It was never a real partnership between us because he never wanted a partnership," she said. "The way he ended it today is proof." Well, Gabay's decision is the latest realignment ahead of the election, and more are expected. On Saturday, two right-wing ministers, Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, announced that they were splitting from their Jewish Home party to form a new grouping that they hope will attract a mixture of secular and religious voters. Benny Gantz, a popular former Armed Forces chief of staff, has also signaled his intention to run by forming a new centrist party. Netanyahu currently leads what is seen as the most right-wing government in Israel's history and says he would like to have a similar coalition after elections. Opinion polls predict his Likud party will take 27 and 31 seats despite corruption allegations against its leader, Netanyahu, while the Zionist Union was credited with just 8 to 9 seats. Israel's Attorney General is expected to announce his decision on whether to charge Netanyahu in the coming months. The Premier would not be required to step down if he's indicted. So that's a very compelling situation there. And we're going to jump around the world to see what else is going on. Evidently, Peru's Vizcarra is ready to dismiss a prosecutor over the Odebrecht, a Brazilian company's corruption probe. Peruvian President Martin Vizcarra is said to carry Congress, to ask Congress to declare the public prosecutor's office in a state of emergency after the agency's top official removed two key investigators at the heart of a probe into a major graft scandal. The two agents, ex-chief prosecutor Jose Domingo Perez and former fiscal coordinator Rafael Vela, had been leading an investigation into whether people at the highest level of power had accepted vast sums of money from Brazilian construction group Odebrecht. The team Perez and Vela helped lead had targeted four former Peruvian presidents, the current opposition leader, and several construction companies. All have denied wrongdoing. Now, Attorney General Pedro Chavarri's decision to remove Perez and Vela was announced days after Perez accused Chavarri of allegedly obstructing justice in a separate case involving several judges accused of corruption. The Shavari said the duo had failed to respect authority at the agency, but Shavari's move prompted a public outcry where there is strong support for the president's anti-corruption crusade. There have been two nights of widespread protests across the country, with the capital of Lima seeing thousands of people take to the streets, shouting their support for the removed prosecutors. "The people support you," the marchers cried out. Perus Vizcarra, attending the inauguration of President Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, cut short his trip to deal with the public uproar, declaring he would fight corruption and impunity. The attorney general is profoundly damaging the interests of Peru and causing outrage among citizens, he said in a terse statement, backing the will of the protesters. Vizcarra said he would personally present a bill to Peru's Congress at 1 p.m. local time on Wednesday, that's today, seeking the state of emergency and asked for legislative support to usher it through quickly and without conflict. "We will use all the tools in our Constitution to overturn this decision, and we ask that all branches of government do the same," Vizcarra told reporters after meeting with his cabinet and advisors in Lima. A state of emergency would allow Vizcarra to quickly and efficiently make changes to personnel he deems necessary to advance the high-profile investigation. The two deposed investigators had earlier this month declared they would seek fines of approximately $180 million from politicians, businessmen, and companies for taking kickbacks involving Odebrecht construction projects in Peru. Odebrecht in 2016 admitted in a plea deal with U.S., Brazilian, and Swiss authorities that it had bribed several officials in dozens of countries, including Peru. The incident, or the president, rather, said on Monday that Odebrecht should not be able to continue working in Peru because the Brazilian construction company was contaminated and had admitted bribing of public officials. So very, very compelling set of news coming out of Peru. Again, we find that more and more places are becoming emboldened in their conduct. And we find that, too, out of China. China's Xi Jinping threatens Taiwan with force, but also seeks a peaceful reunification. Well, China reserved the right to use force to bring Taiwan under its control, but will strive to achieve peaceful reunification, quote-unquote, with a self-ruled island that has a bright future under any future Chinese rule, President Xi Jinping said today. Taiwan is China's most sensitive issue and is claimed by Beijing as its sacred territory. Xi has stepped up pressure on the democratic island since Tsai Ing-wen from the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party became president in 2016. Tsai rejected Xi's call and instead urged China to embrace democracy. Xi has set great personal store in resolving what the Communist Party calls the Taiwan issue, holding a landmark setting with then-Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou in Singapore back in 2015, just before Tsai was elected. Xi spoke at Beijing's Great Wall of the People on the 40th anniversary of a landmark Taiwan policy statement. He said that reunification must come under a one China principle that accepts Taiwan as part of China. Anathema to supporters of Taiwan independence, adding that the one country, two systems model of autonomy with which China governs Hong Kong was the best way for Taiwan. China translates the word Tong Yi as reunification, but it can also be translated as unification, a term in English preferred by supporters of Taiwan independence who point out the communist government has never ruled Taiwan and so it cannot be reunified. The vast majority of Taiwan's people are clearly aware that Taiwan independence would lead to a grave disaster. She told an audience that included Taiwan business people and senior party officials, "Chinese people don't attack other Chinese people. We are willing to use the great sincerity and expend the greatest hard work to strive for the prospect of peaceful reunification," she said. "We do not promise to renounce the use of force and reserve the option to use all necessary measures, quote, to achieve this goal and prevent Taiwan independence," he said. This, though, was aimed at foreign forces who sought to interfere, and the tiny minority of Taiwan independence forces and their activities, she said, without elaborating in what was likely a reference to the United States, Taiwan's strongest backer. Speaking to reporters, Tsai had said that Taiwan would never accept one country, two systems, and was proud of its democratic way of life. The vast majority in Taiwan resolutely oppose one country, two systems. This is the Taiwan consensus, she said. We call on China to bravely step only by doing so can it truly understand the people of Taiwan's thinking and insistence. She reiterated that China was willing to talk with any party in Taiwan to push the political process stalled by China since Tsai took office, as long as they accept the One China principle. Underscoring China's nervousness about U.S. support, in particular for Taiwan, U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday signed into law the Asia Reassurance Initiative Act, which reaffirms the U.S. commitment to Taiwan, including arms sales. She sought to reassure people in Taiwan that there was nothing to fear about Chinese rule, even though most people there have shown no interest in being run by autocratic Beijing. Well, after peace reunification, Taiwan will have lasting peace and the people will enjoy good and prosperous lives. With the great motherland support, Taiwan compatriots' welfare will be even better. Their development space will be even greater, she had said. Tsai, who says she wants to maintain the status quo with China, said on Tuesday that China must use peaceful means to resolve its differences with Taiwan and respect its democratic values. Beijing has regularly sent military aircraft and ships to circle the island on drills in the past few years and has heaped pressure on the island internationally, including whittling down its few remaining diplomatic allies. Taiwan is gearing up for presidential elections in a year. Tsai's party suffered stinging losses to the China-friendly Kuomintang in mayoral and local elections in November. She was speaking on the anniversary of the, quote, message to compatriots in Taiwan, end quote, on January 1 of 1979, when China declared an end to what had been routine artillery bombardment of Taiwan-controlled offshore islands and offered to open up communication between the two sides. However, the offer was rebuffed by Taiwan's then-president Chiang Ching-kuo, who in April that year came out with three no's: policy of no contact, no compromise, and no negotiation with China. Chiang only relaxed that in 1987, allowing people in Taiwan to visit China for family reunions. His father, Chiang Kai-shek, fled with defeated nationalist forces to Taiwan in December of 1949 after losing a civil war to the communists. And that was the situation then. Well, this is also very compelling. Turns out food aid was stolen in the Houthi-controlled areas as Yemen starves. It's a mind-boggling situation here. Food aid meant for starving Yemenis is being stolen and sold in some areas controlled by the Houthi movement. The United Nations World Food Program says the Houthis are backed by the Iranians, and the UN World Food Program has threatened to suspend some of its shipments unless the theft stops. Quote, there are certain Houthi elements that don't care about the people. They are literally diverting aid, and we are demanding it be stopped because innocent people are the victims here. The World Food Program Executive Director David Beasley said, quote, children are dying in Yemen because they haven't enough food to eat. That is an outrage, and this criminal behavior must stop immediately. Very interesting that they said this, but what's really fascinating is that the UN World Food Program was unaware that the Houthis were stealing the food and they were under the control of the Iranians. And this is what goes on with United Nations oversight on so many issues. It is outrageous. I mean, it just really doesn't stop. And you really wonder what's wrong with these people who are supposed to be doing what they can to fix all these things and do it correctly. Well, let me quickly go back to the studio screen. And I wanted to check up some other things with you. 1 second. Where is it here? 1 moment here. 1 second. Where did I lose that? I must have just lost this. 1 second. I'm almost there. I'm looking through some of my notes. Okay, let's just see what's happening here. Somalia orders a top UN envoy to leave over Roubaix detention criticism. Somalia's government has ordered the United Nations top envoy to the country to leave, accusing him of deliberately interfering with the country's sovereignty after raising concerns over the detention of former Islamist leader Muhtar Roubaix. The envoy had also questioned the involvement of Somalia's UN-backed security services in the violence that erupted following Roubaix's arrest and which left at least 15 people dead. Now, the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Somalia, Nicholas Haysom, is no longer welcome in Somalia and cannot operate in the country, the foreign ministry said in a statement late Tuesday. There was no immediate reaction from the United Nations mission in Somalia. Somalian security used force to put down 3 days of demonstration in the southwestern town of Baidoa on the 13th to the 15th of December, with at least 15 people killed and 300 people arrested, according to the United Nations. Protesters were angry at the arrest of Muhtar Roubaix, a former Islamist leader who was vying for a post of regional presidency. Roubaix, who defected from the jihadist al-Shabaab movement in 2017, was detained by the government, accused of seeking to undermine stability, and flown to the capital of Mogadishu. His arrest came just days after a much postponed regional election for the president of Somalia's southwest state. Roubaix's run for office exposed the tensions between Somalia's federal states, which want greater autonomy from a national administration keen to safeguard its central powers. Now, the United Nations mission in Somalia is tasked with supporting peace efforts and the strengthening of government institutions in the Horn of Africa nation, which was left ruined by decades of civil war. As part of that, the United Nations supports policy officers, including with stipends, salary payments, logistics, uniforms, and training. Haysom wrote to the Somali government on December 30 requesting details of the legal basis for the arrest of Roubaix, as well as calling for investigation into the death during the protest following his detention. In his letter, Haysom urged Somali authorities to exercise its authority in conformance with the law and provide explanation about the atrocities committed in Baidoa last month and the detention of Muhtar Roubaix. The UN mission in Somalia faces frequent attacks. On Tuesday, 3 people were wounded, including 2 United Nations staff members, when gunmen fired a barrage of mortars into the main UN base in Mogadishu. The Shabaab, an al-Qaeda affiliate fighting to overthrow the internationally backed government, claimed responsibility for the attack. Haysom, a South African lawyer and experienced diplomat who was previously the United Nations Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, was appointed to the post in Somalia in September of 2018. Well, so that's the story there. Well, I see that we've got a couple of moments here. Let's find out what's going on in the Yonkers Tribune, and we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. Another number to reach out to if you want to get in touch with the Yonkers Tribune is a 347 number, 415-4326. So 347-415-4326. Now let's quickly see if we can cover Ireland. Evidently, Ireland is going to open embassies in a drive to cut its reliance on the UK. Ireland has ramped up plans to expand its diplomatic footprint as Brexit looms, with the opening of more than a dozen new missions in locations as diverse as Latin America, India, Africa, the Middle East, and New Zealand. The biggest expansion of the country's embassy network since it achieved independence from Britain in the 1920s is part of an attempt to forge new global markets for Irish companies. The UK is Ireland's biggest import partner and its second largest export market after the United States, exposing Dublin to the risk of severe economic fallout if Britain leaves the European Union without a deal in March. Across the country, across the world, we have about 80 diplomatic missions. Over the next few years, that's going to be over 100. As we expand, said Simon Coveney, the Deputy Premier and Foreign Minister. Ireland has opened embassies in countries such as New Zealand for the first time, while establishing new consulates or representative offices in the United States, Canada, and Germany, where it has long had a permanent ambassador. Now, in addition to the recently opened mission in Wellington, New Zealand, Ireland also opened missions in Vancouver in Canada and Monrovia in Liberia last year. It will open another seven this year. It's going to open one in India, Colombia, Chile, Jordan, Wales, as well as Los Angeles in the U.S. and Frankfurt in Germany. Another three missions will open in 2020, Ukraine, the Philippines, and Morocco, with a further 13 to open by 2025. We're doing it at a pace that hasn't happened since independence, and we're having to take on a lot more staff and spend more money, Mr. Coveney told reporters in the foreign ministry. There's a method behind this. There's an element of a Brexit strategy about looking for a new market to allow sectors that may have an over-reliance on the UK to be able to expand into some of these new markets. Ireland moved decades ago to widen its diplomatic reach beyond the power centers of London, Washington, and Brussels. The country's long push into China, where it has opened diplomats and consulates rather in Shanghai and Hong Kong, in addition to its Beijing embassy, is the template for the latest expansion, Mr. Coveney had said. 6 or 7 years ago, when I went to China, we were selling less than 100 million euros worth of food. We're now selling 1 billion worth of euros. China is now the third largest market for Chinese, for Irish food and drink. That shows what can be done in 5 to 7 years. That's all it's taken. And despite Brexit, Mr. Coveney said that Dublin was determined to continue working closely with London. The governments plan an annual joint conference involving, quote, significant numbers of ministers on both sides. And similarly, German cabinet meetings and joint meetings of Spanish and Portuguese ministers. I think that in this kind of structure, what is needed to replace all of the meetings that we will have in Brussels and at the moment where British and Irish ministers meet regularly. So we will work hard to make sure that our closest neighbor and the country that has and continues to have the most influence on Ireland, both historically and in the future, will stay close. So that's what's going on over there. Now, I'm going to check one thing here. Let me just quickly see if I could do something else. Let me play another commercial for you, and then we'll be right back. Let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. Let's find out what Pelosi and Schumer are doing. They are planning to bid to reopen the U.S. government. Democrats on Capitol Hill are planning a quick legislative blitz to try to end the U.S. government shutdown, making the issue their first order of business when they take partial control of Congress this week. The aim is to pressure President Donald Trump into caving in as a budgetary standoff over his border wall threatens to run into a third week. Nancy Pelosi, who is tomorrow expected to lead the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives, and Chuck Schumer, the party's leader in the Senate, said in a joint statement as they were preparing to take action to lead our country out of this mess, end quote. Well, they said they would work to pass separate bills funding for the country's federal agencies. The U.S. government has been partially closed since December 22. As Democrats in the White House spar over Mr. Trump's insistence on the inclusion of funding for a wall on the Mexican border to fulfill one of his key pledges from the 2016 presidential election campaign, and Democrats have consistently said they oppose funding the wall. Now, the Democratic legislation, due to be approved as well as soon as lawmakers are sworn in tomorrow, would reopen all federal agencies until the end of September, I can't answer those calls, so let me just see if there's something here. I'm not quite sure. I'm going to just check because we're getting a call in, but I don't think I have the capacity to call. I mean, I have the capacity to call out, but I don't have the number and to call. And no, I don't have it listed. Okay, so I don't know. It doesn't seem to be any trouble at our end. So Not going to be worried about it. Okay. So Nancy Pelosi. So I read this. The U.S. government has been partially closed since December 22 as Democrats and the White House fought over Mr. Trump's insistence on the inclusion of funding for a wall on the Mexican border to fulfill one of his key pledges. I read that. The Democratic legislation due to be approved as soon as new lawmakers are sworn in tomorrow would reopen all federal agencies until the end of September. That's the end of September. So that's of this year of 2019. So that would be quite a long stretch, except for the Department of Homeland Security. Now, that department responsible for border security would be funded only until February 8 without any new money for a wall, offering a five-week window for compromise on the issue. So there were no signs the White House would accept the proposed solution, meaning a rapid conclusion of the standoff was unlikely. So the Democrats, much as I suspected, have allocated no money for a new wall, Mr. Trump tweeted yesterday. Without a wall, there can be no real security, no real border security. Okay, so that situation there. And let me see, I've got a few minutes here. I'm going to just check and see what else is going on here. And one moment. I'm going to just move on to another place, and we'll move on in a second. All right, let me just see where we go from here. Okay, this is where we are, and I wanted to check something else out with you, and bear with me one moment. Okay. I'm going to just check if anything else has happened here in the States, in the U.S., and just to make sure that we catch up. All right. I think we are caught up, actually. I think we are. So let me just go back to our studio screen. All right. And it doesn't look like we have a caller. It's about 20. It's about 20 minutes, almost 20 minutes to 11. So I'll just wait another moment. And if not, we'll just shut down because we don't have a guest afterwards. And I think we covered quite a bit of ground. Oh, what I could do is bear with me one more second. I could just check something else out on the local level. And we'll see in a moment. So I think there is some stuff that we can share with you on the local level. One thing that's interesting, we posted the Governor Cuomo's progressive agenda and inaugural speech that took place on Ellis Island, and you'll be able to read that on the Yonkers Tribune website. It's the top article on the left, so it's really quite powerful. And then let me just see, there are some other things that are happening, and I'll take a quick look in a moment before we move on. Okay. All right, so I'm gonna take a quick look at what's going on locally. Evidently, Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's a Democrat out of Massachusetts, fired the starting pistol for the 2020 presidential race Monday when she announced she was forming an exploratory committee for a White House bid. Now, Warren is the first top-tier candidate to take such a major step, but plenty of others are expected to follow soon. Now, here, the initial rankings of the Democratic field are definitely there. Now, the Representative Beto O'Rourke, a Democrat of Texas, the old cliche holds that Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love when it comes to selecting presidential nominees. If that's true, it is good news for Mr. O'Rourke, who excited Democrats nationwide, even while failing in his bid to unseat Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican of Texas, in the fall. Now, Mr. O'Rourke came within 3 points of defeating Cruz in the strongly Republican state. More to the point, he proved to be a magnetic president, a presence on the campaign trail and a fundraising juggernaut. He raised an astonishing $38 million in the third quarter of 2018 alone. Now, a number of aides to former President Obama have also talked up O'Rourke, drawing comparisons between his appeal and that of the former president. Obama himself told his former aide David Axelrod that O'Rourke exhibited a similar sense of authenticity. The reason I was able to make a connection with a sizable portion of the country was because people had a sense that I said what I meant, Obama told Axelrod, adding O'Rourke. It felt as if he based his statements and his positions on what he believed, which is very, very compelling. I'm just checking the screen just to make sure, but we don't have a call coming in. So Obama himself, there are still plenty of skeptics, however. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, himself a former Obama chief of staff, complained in a late November MSNBC interview, quote, "He lost. You don't usually promote a loser," end quote. Commentators supportive of Senator Bernie Sanders have also sought to knock the gloss off O'Rourke in recent weeks, questioning the Texan's progressive credentials. But those attacks show just how much of a threat O'Rourke poses to the rest of the field. Now, Sanders is a divisive figure in the Democratic Party, not least because he is not a member of it. But the Vermont Independent has won a hugely devoted following with the Democratic Socialist ideals that he has been pushing for decades before they became fashionable. He also has the organizational advantages that come from his much stronger than expected 2016 showing against eventual nominee Hillary Clinton. So ironically, Sanders' best chance for 2020 success could be to ape what President Trump did in the 2016 GOP primaries. There were plenty of Republicans implacably opposed to Trump, but their votes were split among a larger field, and that field allowed Trump to roll up victory after victory with a plurality of the vote. And there are dangers of Sanders. Warren's all but inevitable campaign candidacy could split the progressive vote, while O'Rourke could draw the young voter who flocked to Sanders by 2012. And Sanders would also be 79 by Inauguration Day of 2021. But make no mistake, Sanders is a real contender if he runs. So very, very compelling, to say the least. Okay, we're going to finish this story and then we'll close for the day. All right. So, ironically, Sanders, I think I just read that. There are dangers for Sanders. Okay. All but inevitable candidacy could split the progressive vote, while O'Rourke could draw the young voters who flocked to Sanders in 2016. Sanders would also be 79 by Inauguration Day 2021. But make no mistake, Sanders is a real contender if he runs. Now, Joe Biden's another. Biden leads almost all opinion polls at this stage, and how you rate has chances against largely on how much you think that matters. A CNN poll earlier this month showed Biden with 30% support more than double the level of second-place Sanders, who grabbed 14%. A Suffolk University USA poll showed Democrats were more excited about a run by Biden than anyone else. So very compelling, to say the least. Okay. Well, it looks like that we're not having a call from the mayor. I'm going to just check, and I'm going to disconnect. And in case I get a hold of the mayor, we'll call you back. So we'll pick up where we left off. So there'll be a little bit of a break for a moment. Okay, well, it turns out that the mayor is still in a meeting, so we can't wait for him to show up, so we won't be able to speak to him today. So that's it for us. I had not planned more than a half hour, so we were expecting him to show up, but he evidently can't. So he's stuck at that meeting, and I'm sure the meetings are important. And so that's where we are today. And I guess what we'll do is we'll speak to tomorrow. Our broadcast tomorrow will be with Driving Me Crazy folks. We're talking about John and Lori Wiles, and also Winston Morrow. And so we're going to talk to them and find out about one of the cars that they're that they reviewed. I know that one of the cars that Lori and John reviewed is the Hyundai Elantra Unlimited. It's a sedan, and the way we hear it, insiders tell us that it's really an unbelievably fantastic car. It's beautiful, affordable, and we'll see if they loved it as much as what our insiders are telling us about what's been said about the car. So we'll find out what's going on tomorrow. And so I want to thank you for being with us today. All the best. And again, Happy New Year to everyone. Appreciate it. And have a great day. We'll speak to you tomorrow at 10.